Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
Please keep in mind that these recordings may not be as high quality as they usually are because we're doing them in a time of social distancing.
In this episode, we speak with Martha, Abigail, and Ellie, three extraordinary, talented, and engaged young women who came together to start a project called the International Zoom Room. They've been holding conversations online with people all around the world to document different experiences of the current coronavirus pandemic. We got so intrigued, we wanted to hear some of the things they've learned.
I am currently in Wicklow in Ireland.
I'm in Madrid.
I'm in Beijing, China.
In New Delhi, India.
Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
In the Italian part of Switzerland.
I'm from Rome.
I'm from Japan.
I am from Austria.
I'm in Seoul, South Korea now.
I live in Russia. I'm Russian.
And I'm in Sydney, Australia.
What happened here is that we chat for long hours at the windows. We sing every night. Everyone gets out with a little candle every night. And that was really an opportunity I think would have never happened if it wasn't for this situation. And I'm really grateful.
I would like you guys to introduce yourselves one at a time at the beginning here and just why you're involved in this project.
Sure. The project that we're working on is called the International Zoom Room. And my name is Abigail Tisch, and this project was brought to me by Martha and Ellie together. I was living in Tel Aviv at the time that it was brought to me, and what interests me specifically about the project is the long-term aspect of documenting and connecting people over the course of the dynamic changes in this pandemic. And what people's experiences look like and how they are expressed to one another, both in the moment and then retroactively.
I am Martha Epstein, and I am interested in this project because I, since the very beginning of quarantine, have been particularly struck by the global nature of this time and spent a lot of time thinking about the fact that the entire world is going through the same thing or the same kind of thing at the same time, which is something I had never experienced before in my life. So I remember, like, especially in the first few weeks when I was getting used to sitting at home all day inside in New York City and thinking, wow, someone my age in Japan, in Italy, in France, in Spain, and all over the world is doing the same thing and spending their days similarly and figuring out how to deal with this new reality. And so I'm very interested in bringing us together to meet and discuss and figure out how to go forward together.
Ellie, how about you?
Yeah, hi, I'm Ellie Gravitt. I usually live in New York City, but I'm home in Connecticut with my family for the time being. And I'm a filmmaker and writer sometimes. So of course, at the beginning of this, I was like, I'm gonna write a play about coronavirus. I think I came to this experience with the curiosity of somebody who was just trying to figure out how people were feeling at the moment. And I originally like sat my family down and I did like an interview style. I told them that I was doing a, what was the word that I used, Martha?
Focus group.
I said, okay, I'm going to focus group you guys. And I asked them like a bunch of questions and they were all like badly formed questions about their emotional state. But the conversation ended up being really interesting. And that's where it started for me. And then I came to Martha with that idea. And she told me that she was already in the process of imagining a conversation with people all over the world. And we sort of meshed the two. And that's how it started for us.
It was a bit of like, yeah, separate ideas intersecting at just the right point, because I had this very unformed, just like fantasy of a Zoom room with a bunch of people around the world that were strangers. And that was all I had really thought about and know what we would do together. But I was like, I want to to see other people who are doing this in different places and learn how it's similar and learn how it's different. And then Ellie had a more fleshed out focus group idea of collecting, like documenting the personal experience, like the lived experience of this time. And she was telling me about that just casually. And then I was like, oh wait, she can help make this, like we can combine our ideas of the international people and then Abigail started as a participant. We asked her to join in. And she, because she was living in Israel at the time, and then she was like, yeah, I love this idea, and also this won't work, this will work, but you know, and suddenly she was like a producer, so.
That's great.
So how many people have you interviewed so far, for how much time, and for how many countries?
We have spoken to 45 different people, which is pretty amazing. I think the number is 20 countries, 21? 22 countries and like something like 40 different cities within those countries, which is pretty amazing. We've talked to people from the age of 9 to 6 continents. Yeah. And people from the age of like 9 years old to what, 89 years old, something like that. And we usually have a conversation with 4, 5, or 6 different people on Zoom, including one of us who moderates, and they last about an hour, and we have like 5 questions. The questions have shifted over the course of all the conversations because we've been trying to refine them based on how the conversations go and also what we're interested in. And everybody answers each question, and then we try to open it up for discussion at the end, and people can ask each other some questions that they're curious about. So yeah, they're usually about an hour long.
Can you list the 5 questions for us?
We usually start off by asking people, just kind of like you did, to go around and say, you know, who they are, where they're living in the world, who they're living with, what age they are. And then we ask them a series of changing questions about their experience, but usually kind of starting with paint a picture of what it's like where you are, because we want to capture both kind of the experience of the geographical diversity as well as the kind of emotional range that people are dealing with. So we don't want to lose one for the other. So we start by asking people just to describe where they are in the world. Then we usually ask them about something that's comfortable and something that's difficult for them in this time. Then we usually ask them to share an interaction that they've had with another person that is distinct to this time, or something along those lines that captures an element of relationship or community. And then we ask a predictive question about what do they imagine this will, what do they imagine will come of this? What will they remember? How long will this last? Even small things that will be interesting to look back on historically. And then we kind of shift back from that kind of in the future historical lens back into the present and ask them what they hope will come from the situation. So we usually always end on a hopeful note, but we are conscious and curious about the difficulties that people are experiencing through it as well.
What happened here is that 2 months ago, when the lockdown started, Mattia and I, we opened the window and we played a very known Italian song at 9 p.m. And from that day on, that was 62 days ago, we played every night 3 songs at 9 p.m. And we met through the windows a lot of people that have been living here as we are. For many years, we didn't recognize each other, whereas now we chat for long hours at the windows. We sing every night. Everyone gets out with a little candle every night. And that was really an opportunity I think would have never happened if it wasn't for the situation. And I'm really grateful.
What have you learned from the diversity? Have people's responses been similar or different?
I think that one of the striking things that I've noticed is that when we get to that last question about hope, every single call we've had, at least one person mentioned the environment. which has just been really powerful and also hope inspiring for us, because it seems like a lot of people's hearts have turned to that as a place for optimism right now. And just the idea that we can actually enact change really quickly on a global scale if we have to, quote unquote, and it's been proven to us through this. And then there's also a lot of conversation about like kindness and just a shift in like interpersonal relationships and connection that come from a pause like this, and also from like a lot of reflection that's happening all over the world because of that pause. Those are the things that stood out to me in terms of that last question.
Martha?
It's also worth mentioning that even in the nine, this was a surprise to me, but even in the conversation with the nine-year-olds yesterday, we got the climate change response from one of the girls who said, I might be crazy, but I think the sky is getting clearer. She probably heard that from
me. That's great. What about the negative experiences? Are there common anxieties or experiences?
One thing that I love actually about hosting these groups is kind of the transparency that people give about their fears, uncertainties, and negative experiences, because to host a session and to focus only on the silver lining would be kind of cloaking the reality of this fearful moment. And we do hear a lot of anxieties and fears, kind of even from very old people, which we're usually asking old people, you know, come give us your wisdom and your optimism. And sometimes they give us some real fear and uncertainty.
What about cultural differences between the countries?
Well, there was one conversation in the one where we spent about 25 minutes talking about the streets and what it's like outside. I was fascinated by the cultural differences there, because we had someone from the Netherlands spoke, and then right after someone from South Africa spoke, and just the what they were describing in terms of what it was like sort of emotionally outside could not have been more different. You know, in the Netherlands, they have what's called an intelligent lockdown, something like that, an intelligence lockdown. And basically the government's like, we're going to trust you to do the right thing to help one another. No one's going to be on your case about it, but please stay inside. And they were like, and everyone is, or, you know, whereas in South Africa, she was talking about going for a drive and getting pulled over by the police and people being beaten by, you know, an old woman that she knew of being beaten by police for not having proof of this. There, it was just so fascinating to hear people back to back giving such different explanations of what it's like outside. And it seemed, even just from my vague understandings of what those cities were like or countries, it seemed to fit the cultural tendencies of those places.
And something else that occurred to me when you asked about patterns that we noticed is that people have spoken a lot about inequities being exposed through this, socioeconomic differences that were so long ignored because they could be. Particularly, we spoke to a woman in Mumbai, India, and also in Switzerland. And when you're seeing how this is impacting people of different socioeconomic status, and you can't not see it because of the way that the world is working right now, it's just exposing a lot of what was there before that was going undiscussed. And both people that we spoke to said that they were hopeful. I mean, they're both also like human rights activists, but they were very hopeful that from this exposure will come great change.
Have you experienced your own transformation in talking to these people, or more sense of global identity? What has it been for you to connect with so many different people?
Yeah, I actually was a participant like a few weeks in, because we had a smaller group and we said, well, why don't you just like come in as the United States ambassador for this conversation? And it's funny because we always have a little debrief after these chats, and I was like really struck by how much I enjoyed participating, even though I knew what questions were going to be asked, because there's something really special about processing how you are experiencing something with a group of strangers and getting to to get quite personal with people that you don't know about how you've been feeling and how your thinking has been changing was really cathartic for me. And I hope that that's one thing that these conversations do offer to the people that we've spoken to. I also really quickly, like, there's so much burnout from talking about the freaking coronavirus. And I know we've probably all experienced, like, in your day-to-day conversations, you're talking about coronavirus again, and then you go, oh, I don't want to be talking about this. But the cool thing about these conversations is, like, rarely, if ever, is the actual virus mentioned. Like, we're going into, okay, so what does this mean for you? And it just feels like we're actually talking about the thing, the so what of it all. And I know that at least at first I was concerned about that burnout, and I was concerned that I personally would not be able to, like, these conversations wouldn't be sustainable for me. But it's really been quite the opposite. It's like actually addressing the elephant in the room. So, like, how are you doing with the fact that you're stuck with your family for 3 months as a 25-year-old? Projecting.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, because you're talking about a relatedness, not having news come at you, but being a participant, like, in a dialogue. And I think it makes a huge difference for people.
World War II, we stood in ration lines, and we didn't go places because we didn't have gasoline. But somehow, life seemed to have gone on. And then there was the polio epidemic, which I was sort of almost born into. And because when I went to kindergarten, they wouldn't let us play in a sandbox because of the polio epidemic. But that, too, was sort of remote. Everything else seemed to have an ending.
I'm super surprised what I think Abby said about older people being as surprised. I don't know how you put it exactly, but maybe as overwhelmed as younger people, because I thought, or in my own experience is normally older people, especially the war generation, you know, some are more resilient, some are more relaxed.
I think there is definitely more of a resilience. I think there is a greater understanding of the need to rise with action and respond with action as opposed to kind of hiding under the covers. And I think the fears are more that action won't come rather than like what will happen to the world. I find that interesting. I hear a lot of older people saying, like, this is the time to get up, like, you guys better do it.
Yeah.
And I don't hear that as much from younger people. I hear more of the overwhelming kind of fears of the moment. And with older people, it doesn't seem like a lack of resilience, but there is definitely an anxiety and a resounding, we have never seen anything like this, even though they've been through World War II and World War whatever, they've been through it all. It's still new.
Yeah. I just had a neighbor kid here, and she's like, so what was it like in the first pandemic? And I was like, there is no first pandemic. This is the first one. So maybe, is there anything really surprising to you where you're like, oh, you know, just like me now, where you're like, okay, first pandemic ever. Anything surprising, whether it's personal or within the conversation, what came up, where you just didn't expect?
Yeah, yesterday we were speaking to the 9-year-olds. Martha ran that conversation and it was brilliant. And I was surprised by a lot of it because, as children do, they were surprisingly like brilliant and profound. And one of our questions that Abigail mentioned, we like to have a little record of prediction for when this will be like over, quote unquote, because it's just good to have a record of how right or wrong we were. And this little 9-year-old, Martha's like, so when do you think this will feel like it's over? And she said, well, I don't think it'll ever really be over. And of course, we were all like, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, like the flu, there's a vaccine for the flu, but people still get the flu and you get a flu shot. People are going to keep getting the coronavirus. Hopefully we'll be able to treat it, but it's not going anywhere. And I was knocked out by that. A, it's true and terrifying, but B, her, I don't know, her conviction and her sort of little bravery about it kind of calmed me down, because it's just a better way to look at it. Like, when will it be over is maybe not the question we should be asking. So that was really striking to me.
And then another 9-year-old on the other extreme gave us our most specific prediction yet. And she very confidently said, there will be 175 cases in the world in September, and then it will be done.
So that was her. That's great.
Great. But I was also surprised. I mean, the 9-year-olds, I'm sure once I think a bit more, I can think of things that were surprising from the adults. But I was also surprised by so many things the 9-year-old said and their thoughtfulness. And we were asking them if they'll be different at all after this, if they'll think differently about anything after this. And I wasn't sure if they would receive that question. And one of them said that she'll feel lucky now that she can see her friends, and she didn't really feel lucky to be able to be with friends before, but now she will. And I was very touched that she had that level of thought, and I was surprised by that. And like, you know, that there's, we hear that in a more adult version from the adults, but just this appreciation to be together and for what we have, like sort of restructuring our priorities. All the ages have noted that.
And I wasn't that sad because I was kind of hoping, because I was like, oh my God, it'd be so cool if we didn't have school and we had it all online.
Right.
Yeah, but I didn't realize like we might not be able to go to camp or I won't really see my friends. Like I didn't really understand.
So I think we're going to wrap up with a question that you ask, which is, what do you predict for the future and where do you see the world going with respect to this virus?
I am a counter-swinging optimist, meaning that my tendency is to be more of a pessimist, but I like to swing that purposefully back in the other direction. So I have a pretty kind of forcibly optimistic view of what this world will be afterwards. I think I've heard a lot of people voice this, and I am in agreement that a lot of the kind of fluff and the unnecessary trivial things that we cared about, whether it's material things or kind of frivolous social annoyances that weren't very meaningful, will kind of dissipate to some extent, and people will be realer. Hopefully they will be grittier. Hopefully our generation will have some more grit, particularly. And I think that the only way out of this is through. And because of that, we will emerge much more resilient, much more dynamic, much more prepared, and kind of much more in line with the actual force of nature that is this universe.
I think that I similarly hope that after people have had to spend so much time with themselves, not doing most of the things that they are usually able to do, they will emerge with a much stronger set of priorities about what they want their life to look like and their relationships to look like and their time. So many people that we spoke to talked about valuing time more and not using time as an excuse anymore, because even when faced with an expanse of it, they were unable to tend to certain things. Like, people's relationships with themselves and their priorities, I do think, is shifting, and I think certainly for the better. And then, of course, I just have to say that, again, the fact that we can make such enormous change on a global scale so quickly when we all put our heads together is a proven fact now. And I hope that that shows some real impact in environmental work being done.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, I mean, I echo what's been said. I think that there's great power in the entire world having gone through something together. It's not something that one country can turn a blind eye to because it didn't affect them. And I don't know, I think, I hope that because of that, there'll just be a new outlook on life and our priorities. I've been thinking about the way that this has shown me personally that society is very deconstructible. It suddenly went away in one day, a thing I never thought was possible because I just thought that was the way things had to be and are. So I wonder if we can reconstruct it in a way that allows time to be spent in other ways or allows us to not just take things as the way things are as definitive truth, because everything kind of was constructed and created and we can work together to build it in a way that looks better and acts better and treats people and the world better. Something I've been thinking about that I've been concerned about is I hope that just because people realize things can be done virtually and the world can go on without human interaction, I hope that we don't choose to do that forever. I think there's great value that I am desperately missing of coming together in a room and being together, whether it's an office or a theater or a play date. Like, I hope we don't rely on the virtual world because we saw it's possible.
This is really wonderful. I really enjoyed our conversation and the insights and the learning your group is gathering, and really it's fantastic. And I thank you for actually doing this. I think it's levering the consciousness level of our world and bringing people together and becoming aware of, you know, basically what we just talked about. It's really fantastic.
We do not have a website at this moment, but we do have a Gmail account, which is internationalzoomroom@gmail.com. For anybody who wants to be a participant, please shoot us an email. We will get you signed up. We also have a very handy Calendly that will kind of allow you to select a date and time and session that will work for you. And until we have a website that is kind of up and running and accessible, that's the best place to find us. So please do reach out.
Perfect. You are all three inspiring young activists and creators and artists, and we so appreciate you being on the show. We're excited to spread the word and get more and more people involved in your project. And thank you for being global ambassadors for this trying time for so many people. I love the point that Ellie made about, you know, we've proven now that we can, as a globe, act with we have the consciousness and the wherewithal to do it. We know we can do it. It's proven. And I think to hear it from this generation, from these kids, they're not kids, young women in their 20s who see the capacity of the whole world acting together, and they have the optimism that it can happen, right? That is the kind of hope we're looking for. That's what Pot of Gold is about, is having that aspiration and that vision of a world connected, but a world of people acting together for the benefit.
Yeah, and as I think Martha said it, the system shift, no? This thing that anything can be reconstructed and redesigned to the needs of everyone, including the planet. Mm-hmm. And of this generation, and I say this generation, the 9-year-olds, but actually also us, do not get that, it's going to be difficult in future.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think also that's one of the things Pot of Gold we try to point to is, you know, the world doesn't have to be the way it is. Our economic system doesn't have to be the way it is. And she articulated that so well. Like, I always thought it was just this way. I didn't think it could be another way. But now I see things are not always the way it is. They don't need to be the way it is. And I think that's the kind of hope we're looking for, is that we can question these deeply embedded systems. And we're talking about economic systems, money systems. But it's time for us to question those systems and see what we can imagine that would be better for the world. And to hear that coming from the conversations they're having is really inspiring.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.